This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating the season with Holiday Blend Coffee and Holiday Breakfast Blend Tea at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos-Pierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Gelda.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
the race for Oregon's next governor begins.
Dennis Kucinich has a new bill allowing you to pay taxes without paying for war.
This is the one-year anniversary of the tsunami that devastated Indonesia.
And in the human cost of the occupation in Iraq,
as of today, there have been 2,172 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded.
Iraq body count .org reports 31,115 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News, Tuesday, December 27, 2005. I'm LaToya Hudson.
And I'm Rolf Semprebon.
The Oregonian reports today that the city of Portland is negotiating with residents of Dignity Village on an agreement that would allow the homeless camp to remain on city property at least through 2010. The proposed agreement would essentially allow the village to manage the site with city oversight. That would include regular visits from the police and fire bureaus, as well as detailed records regarding who lives there. The village also would have to be financially sufficient with the help of private fundraising. Once it's completed early next year, the agreement will formalize the city's relationship with the village, which was created 5 years ago and moved to a site on Northeast Sunderland Avenue in September 2001. Andy Miller, a senior program manager at the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, said the agreement might be completed by February. The deal doesn't vary much from the way the city and the village have worked together thus far, but it's more specific and for the first time puts everything in writing. Steve Andrews, the chairman of the camp, said the agreement gives Dignity Village a measure of legitimacy. Dignity Village was created in 2000 as a transitional housing for homeless people who couldn't get into overcrowded shelters. The camp moved from site to site throughout the city and ultimately drew criticism from several fronts. Advocates for the homeless decried a lack of accountability in ensuring that village residents were moving into permanent housing. Others complained about allowing the homeless to camp on public property.
The 663 registered voters in the eastern Oregon town of Athena are being asked whether to recall Mayor Mark Seltman and two members of the city council. The Umatilla County elections deputy says recall ballots were mailed last Friday and must be returned by January 10th. A dozen Athena residents started the recall effort, claiming in petitions that officials have not represented the best interest of the voters. Each petition needed at least 70 signatures from qualified voters to prompt a recall election. Ballots include the reasons cited in the petitions for recalling the officials, as well as statements from the politicians hoping to keep their jobs.
Hundreds of laws passed by the 2005 legislature will take effect on New Year's Day. One of them will stiffen high school graduation requirements. It will apply to students entering high school in the fall of 2006. Lawmakers approved the new law after hearing testimony from various education officials who said the state's existing requirements were some of the weakest in the nation. Starting with the class of 2010, high school students will have to complete 4 years of English to earn a diploma. The class of 2011 will have to contend with a third year of math. In other legislative, the death of a figure skater's mother prompted legislators to pass a new state law requiring passengers in taxis, shuttle vans, and rental limousines to wear seatbelts. Yet another new law will require the Oregon State Police to create a website with lists of high-risk sex offenders.
Months after announcing his candidacy for a second term, State Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner is still waiting for an opponent. Business lobbyists and other critics of the former Democratic lawmaker had hoped Tom Cox would run. But Cox, who recently switched from the Libertarian Party to the Republican Party, decided to run for a Metro Council seat in suburban Portland. I think he saw that he wouldn't get the commitments to win in terms of money and manpower, said J.L. Wilson, the state director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. The filing deadline is March 7th, so there is still time for someone to run.
A retired eye doctor, Dr. Gordon Leach, is the fourth Republican candidate to file in the governor's race. Leach, who has homes in Dundee and Baker City, filed with the Oregon Secretary of State's office on Friday. Leach has said he favors a 50% reduction in property taxes, a 90% cut in the state capital gains tax, and no tax on U.S. gold and silver coin saving accounts interest for accounts in banks chartered by Oregon. He also wants a 30% discount on state income taxes paid in U.S. gold coins, which he calls the true dollar. Leach has written two papers on what he calls traits for tax relief already in the system. He says the dollar in circulation today aren't real because President Franklin Roosevelt took gold coins out of circulation in 1933. Leach graduated from Portland's Lincoln High School in 1951 and Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. His medical degree is from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He served the Navy during the Vietnam War and practiced in Portland and Baker City before retiring in 1994.
The race to capture the Republican and Democratic nominations for governor will grab the headlines next year, but the other political parties are also making a push for the governor's mansion. Members of the Pacific Green and Libertarian parties represent only a small slice of the Oregon electorate. They could, however, emerge as key players in next year's election. By 2002, Libertarian Party candidate Tom Cox drew 4.6% of the vote for governor. That was enough for some Republicans to blame him for costing Kevin Mannix in a race decided by less than 3 percentage points. But with a fiscally conservative and socially liberal platform, it's unclear how many votes the Libertarians took away from Mannix and how many they took away from Governor Kulongowski.
Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreitler, who wants to create a new fraud unit to investigate staged traffic accidents. These can involve a network of lawyers, doctors, chiropractors, and physical therapists. Kreitler says he'll request about $2 million in funding from legislators to create a five-person insurance fraud unit in his department. He says 41 other states have such fraud units. National Insurance Crime Bureau estimates that Washington insurers paid more than $404 million in bogus claims in 2004. That figure is based on what the industry believes is a standard 10% fraud rate in claims.
Holders of the medical marijuana cards in Oregon will be allowed to have as much as 1.5 pounds of dried marijuana and 6 mature plants under a new state law that takes effect January 1st. The increased possession limit, part of an effort to clear up ambiguities in the state's 1998 medical marijuana program, was among the hundreds of new laws approved by the 2005 Oregon legislature. However, in exchange for the increased possession limits, the legislature approved a provision sought by police that patients and caregivers no longer can argue in court that having more than the specified amounts is a medical necessity and therefore permissible. One of the co-sponsors of the new medical marijuana law, State Senator Bill Morissette, said it's aimed at putting the program on more solid footing by making it easier for police to interpret the law and more difficult for criminals to exploit it. The change also has been endorsed by Stormy Ray, a multiple sclerosis patient who was a leading spokeswoman for the 1998 ballot measure authorizing medical marijuana. She said the new law will ensure that she can obtain enough marijuana, which she says helps ease her pain and helps her sleep.
In San Diego last week, 13 medical marijuana dispensaries were raided. On the same day, the DA held a hearing on the federal government right to maintain a monopoly on marijuana cultivation. In today's Eugene Report is the Drug Enforcement Agency working different sides of the medical marijuana issue.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin.
On Monday, December 10th, federal agents raided 13 different medical marijuana dispensaries in the San Diego area. I'm speaking to Hillary McQuee, who is the spokesperson for Americans for Safe Access.
What we do know is that 13 dispensaries in San Diego were raided by the DEA with the help of local law enforcement. Medicine, money, and files and patient records were confiscated. One arrest was made for marijuana. A vendor was coming to one of the dispensaries and he was arrested, but none of the dispensary operators or workers or patients were arrested in that raid for marijuana related offenses.
What do medical marijuana advocates believe is the motivation behind the feds raid?
Unlike most DEA raids, they sought a state warrant. And if they do bring charges, those charges will be in state court. So if people get arrested for medical marijuana on federal charges, they have absolutely no defense available to them. They can't mention California law and their medical condition or what they were providing the medical marijuana for. It just becomes a matter of did you have marijuana or not. So should they charge any of the people involved in these raids, we are confident that if it goes to court and they were operating in full compliance with the law, that they will be exonerated. I think that part of their motivation was to delegitimize California's medical marijuana law. But by doing this, they're saying, oh, these aren't medical. They're admitting that medical marijuana is valid and that medical marijuana providers and patients exist. And their argument for going after people isn't, as it used to be, that medical marijuana doesn't exist or it doesn't help or isn't medicine, but rather these are not the legitimate patients. See, a real change in terms of the rhetoric. We think that the big factor in why they went after San Diego is because of the San Diego County Supervisor's opposition to Prop 215. They have voted to issue a lawsuit against the state for Prop 215. They didn't want to implement the state ID card program, and when they said they weren't going to implement it, some local activists threatened to sue, and their response was say they were going to file in federal court and sue the state for Prop 215. This gave the DEA the political space to come in and do these raids. So whether the San Diego supervisors invited them in or whether the DEA just was taking advantage of the situation, there does seem some suspicious collusion between state and federal officials. And under our California Constitution, state and local officials are required to operate by California law. They are not required to operate by federal law wherein there's a conflict.
Time magazine has come out with their A to Z of medical information and says that marijuana is used for a variety of conditions and is basically identifying it as medicine. When are the feds, if ever, going to get on board with this?
The raids happen the same day as the DEA administration hearing where the government was arguing that they should maintain their monopoly on medical marijuana cultivation. So there's this recognition both in the popular culture and, frankly, on the part of the U.S. government that marijuana is medicine, and now it's an argument of who gets to control that medicine. The federal government still has marijuana in Schedule 1, but has absolutely no scientific validity to it. Drug czar John Walters saying that smoked marijuana is not medicine, so he's not even saying that marijuana is not medicine. So you see all these different actors lining up to be well-positioned when the law changes. And I think our task as activists is to make sure that, yes, this happens, but it happens in a way that doesn't criminalize people that grow their own medicine, that we continue to make this medicine the democratic medicine that it is right now. I think it's very clear that the legal status of at least medical marijuana is going to change, but it's going to change to whose benefit is really the question now.
The raids in San Diego, if some undercover police were able to acquire medicine without the proper paperwork, didn't it seem that just those dispensaries should be addressed as opposed to targeting all 13?
They didn't shut down every dispensary, and if these dispensaries weren't using the best practices, there should be some kind of process where they get fined, or if they do it a second time, they get their license revoked. In a regulatory environment, it's a complete overkill to send in DEA agents and raid patient records. All the dispensaries we spoke to said they always check recommendations, but if they do find evidence, we need to talk about, under a regulatory environment, what is appropriate for people who aren't following the rules.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
The current time is 5:14. Still to come on KBOO Evening News, more on domestic spying, a live interview with Melvin A. Goodman. Cops in New Orleans kill again. More and more pipeline fires in Niger. You are listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Of the six suspects picked up by the FBI early this month and charged with participating in environmental activism involving property crimes, two are from Arizona. There's no connection readily apparent between Sarah Kendall Harvey of Flagstaff and William Rogers of Prescott, but both are alleged by the FBI to be members of the Radical Earth Liberation Front, which has taken responsibility for a series of arson attacks in the Northwest since the mid-1990s. Rogers was found dead in his Flagstaff's jail cell on Thursday, the victim of apparent suicide. Rogers had lived in Prescott, where he ran a combination bookstore community meeting spot called The Catalyst. He supported peaceful causes such as food, not bombs, and an effort to prevent the Snow Basin ski area from using recycled sewage water for snowmaking on the slopes of land sacred to American Indians. His arrest drew support from dozens in Prescott, who described him as a peaceful, warm-hearted man who promoted nonviolence. Harvey is charged in connection with a December 1998 fire at U.S. Forest Industry in Medford, Oregon. The blaze caused damages estimated at $500,000. She could receive 20 years in prison if convicted. The prosecutor said she's suspected of other arsons and is an ELF member.
Dennis Kucinich, Democrat from Ohio, has signed on to a bill sponsored by John Lewis, Democrat of Georgia, to create a Religious Freedom Peace Tax Fund. This would allow a designated conscientious objector opposed to participation in war in any form to have taxes paid into a fund that would not be spent for military purposes. The total number of congressional supporters now stands at 41. Lobbying efforts for this bill are being led by the National Campaign for a Peace Tax and educational work by the Peace Tax Foundation.
Today, a prominent U.S. Islamic group demanded information from the government on who is being targeted in the domestic spy ring being conducted by U.S. intelligence agencies. The move comes after it was revealed last week that the government was secretly conducting radiation tests on mosques throughout the United States. Mitch Jesuit has more from Washington.
The Council for American Islamic Relations announced a Freedom of Information Act request with the Departments of Justice and Energy for information about a secret radiation testing program that has been conducted without a warrant, reportedly on sites associated with Muslims. It also sent a FOIA request seeking information on who the National Security Agency is secretly spying on.
We would kindly request the government to stop their fishing expeditions and then actually, try and base some of their investigations and their intelligence on actual criminal activity and actual probable cause.
Arslan Iftikhar is the National Legal Director for the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Now, the American Muslim community is, presumed guilty until innocent and presumed suspect solely because of the fact, that they're Muslim. And, we hope that instead of, perpetuating stereotypes and living in an atmosphere of fear, that we will, treat everyone equally under the law.
On Friday, the FBI confirmed that it has been conducting radiation testing, though it did not indicate where. U.S. News and World Report first reported that the FBI has targeted mostly Muslim sites, including mosques, homes, and businesses. In 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that law enforcement must get warrants before using devices that can search through walls for criminal activity. But the Justice Department claims that the case does not apply to air monitoring surveillance programs when conducted in public areas. The DOJ also says it's concerned with what it calls a growing body of evidence that Al-Qaeda is seeking to use weapons of mass destruction.
Government has admitted that it's been spying on its own people, on Quakers who are avowed pacifists, even grandmothers, some of whom have done nothing more threatening than join a peace rally or attend a meeting. It's absurd.
Janice Fields with the Quaker group American Friends Services Committee speaks of a case in Denver in which a FOIA request revealed that anti-war protesters were being spied upon.
The concern of ours is, do we really want to go back to those days of COINTELPRO when peaceful groups were spied upon? Peaceful radicals like Martin Luther King Jr. Was spied upon. I mean, we, fought this in the 70s, and here we are, deja vu, back in 2005, looking back to rolling back the clock and going back to those days. And we're very concerned about that.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jesurich in Washington.
News that the Bush administration has engaged in massive electronic surveillance operations against federal law has put activists across the country on alert. Live on the phone to talk about federal surveillance trends and issues is Melvin A. Goodman, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Rolf. Good to be with you.
First, can you give us your interpretation over how widespread the federal government's domestic surveillance program is?
Well, I think we've only scratched the surface. You can be sure that we're just getting the tip of the iceberg here, that this is probably a wide program that's sweeping through all sorts of conversations, emails, faxes, watching rallies, peace rallies, Quaker meetings. Now we've learned that the New York City Police runs its own model program. It's very interesting to me that the Deputy Commissioner of the Police Department for Intelligence is a former colleague of mine at the CIA. He was at the CIA for 30 years and was the Deputy Director of Operations. So I find the connection between the CIA and the New York Police Department to be interesting.
Yeah.
You have to wonder how many municipalities are also running their own program that reminds me of what happened during Vietnam, which was the famous COINTELPRO
program,
which led to the investigation of the FBI and the CIA.
Mel, there are a lot of activists who are becoming increasingly paranoid that they are being watched. What does the government do with the information it collects?
Well, most of it, I think, just sits in data banks, in relay stations, and then when code words are called up, say a conversation that mentions the word terror or terrorism or probably the Middle East or Islamist, then that conversation will be translated. My problem with the program, and I have many problems with the program, is the president himself said last year in a speech in Buffalo that anytime you're talking about a wiretap in this country, you're talking about a court order. Well, it turns out you do have warrantless wiretaps that he has allowed the National Security Agency, which after all is a military agency, in its charter it says it's a combat support agency. And we already know that the Pentagon is sending observers to peace rallies, to Quaker meetings. They're putting names in databases that by law have to be eliminated within 90 days, and they're not doing that.
Yeah.
So there are so many things that are going on that are a break with procedure, a break with law. And in the case of the Bush wiretapping, the warrantless wiretapping, I think you're violating the Constitution.
Yeah.
I think it's a matter of the Fourth Amendment, undue searches and seizures. This is extremely serious business.
Yeah. What would be the chances that any individual activists could be rounded up, like, you know, the environmentalists arrested last week and then charged with terrorist acts?
Well, I think the problem is what started as a terrorist program justified by 9/11 has now gotten a much broader sweep. We're learning about environmentalists, the ecology movement, the peace movement generally. The New York City police were attending a celebration that was mourning the death of a cyclist because the New York City police happens to monitor bicycle rallies to see if there's any break with public order. So who knows where this is going to stop, because you have the wrong people making these decisions. At the National Security Agency, the decision to listen to the conversation of an American is probably made by a sergeant.
Yeah.
You're talking about extremely unsophisticated people in very important jobs making decisions that have great impact on our society. And that's what Bush has essentially unleashed. And it is wrong.
Yeah.
And I think what we need to do is wonder why the New York Times held this story for over a year.
Over a year.
It had the information before the election of 2004. And why so many congressmen, I mean, after all, a dozen congressmen knew about this, two have sent letters. Rockefeller has released his letter to Dick Cheney, the vice president, showing his concerns. But I wonder why the senators did not put more pressure on the White House. I don't think they had to sit there and watch a law being broken just because they were told this in secret information. If you're given secret information that a law has been broken, you've got to report the violation of the law. You've got to report that crime. We're
yeah.
talking about crimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially, we're talking about high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, thanks, Mel. That was, Mel Goodman, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., with some news about the surveillance operations.
American Indian tribes across the country may lose claim to billions of dollars in trust monies at the start of the new year. A statute of limitation established by Congress in 2002 set December 31st of this year as the last day that the American Indian tribes can file claims against the federal government for royalties and leases, the sale of land, and other negotiations handled by the Department of the Interior. FSRN James Kent spoke to tribal leaders and a legal consultant who handled several tribal trust claims against the government.
The Arthur Anderson accounting firm conducted an audit of American Indian tribal trust funds at the request of the federal government and submitted its findings on December 31, 1999. It determined that the Interior Department had mismanaged tribal accounts and had failed to pay tribes monies owed to them. The trust fund accounts were established as a place to deposit monies collected by the federal government for the lease of tribal lands or from royalties for oil and other minerals found on tribal lands. The tribes were encouraged to negotiate settlements with the government rather than file in federal court. One lawsuit, Cobell v. Norton, addresses the mismanagement of thousands of individual American Indian trust accounts by the Department of the Interior and has already been in the federal court system for several years. It's estimated that the Cobell suit addresses in excess of $40 billion. Legal consultant Gary Fisher works with American Indian tribes. He notes that time is rapidly slipping away for any claims on the enormous amounts of money owed to the tribes.
If they do not file a claim by December 31st, it appears as if the statute of limitations will be extinguished and any claim filed thereafter will be subject to dismissal.
Fisher says that of the 540 tribes, three have settled, nine are pending.
And that's it. So these reservations are going to lose out on a lot of money.
A lot of money, explains Fisher, is an estimated $400 billion. U.S. Senators John McCain and Byron Dorgan introduced legislation to extend the statute of limitations, but that bill failed to pass prior to Congress adjourning for the Christmas holidays. With only days left for the tribes to file their petitions, Fisher sees the possible lost tribal revenue as the greatest land grab in America in the last 150 years.
Because if you consider that the reservations are allowed interest on their money, the compound interest for the last 100 years is in essence worth more than the initial claim.
The federal government advised the tribes that there would be a six-year statute of limitations set for tribal trust fund claims. That statute expires on December 31st. The Department of the Interior will not comment on tribal trust funds due to the Cobell case, even though it's a separate issue. Although some tribes are not aware of the statute of limitations, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in north-central South Dakota is. Vice Chairperson Avis Little Eagle notes that her tribe filed this trust fund claim in 2002.
It is very important. We hope all the tribes make sure and do this because we're all involved. Almost all the tribes were done wrong. And they need their leaders, their officials, to make sure that they're looking out for the people's interest.
As for recent reports that the Bush administration is considering the termination of the federal government's American Indian Trust responsibility, Little Eagle remarks,
there is established federal law on how the United States government deals with Indians. There's also the Constitution, which says that the United States signs treaties with the tribes. They're looking at a government-to-government relationship. And so I don't think they can really, today or tomorrow, get out of that relationship. They have a trust responsibility to tribes.
Oglala Sioux Elder Johnson Holy Rock is a former tribal chairman and considered an expert on treaties as well as the U.S. Constitution. Any deviation from its trust responsibilities, as indicated in its treaties with the various tribes, notes Holy Rock, is the equivalent of the federal government violating its own constitution.
We have been subordinated to the degree that the treaties are no longer considered important. But for us, it's just as important today as in the day that treaties were made.
Holy Rock adds that Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution refers to treaties as the supreme law of the land. And that, says the Sioux Elder, supersedes any statute of limitations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
A police spokesman in New Orleans says officers who shot and killed a man waving a knife had no other choice but to use lethal force. He says the man was lunging at them and swinging wildly and wasn't fazed by pepper spray. Witnesses say a half dozen or more shots were fired during yesterday's confrontation on St. Charles Avenue in the Lower Garden District west of downtown. One witness says, "It didn't seem like anyone was going to get hurt to me." The man admitted he didn't see the final moments before the shots rang out. The officers who fired
will be reassigned pending the outcome of the investigation. It's the first shooting involving New Orleans officers since the city reopened after Hurricane Katrina.
Sergeant for class, Jerry Wolfert from Oakland, Oregon, will be a model for a new line of video figures. Based on the sequel to the U.S. Army's video called America's Army, a couple of years ago, the U.S. Army released the video as a recruiting tool. But within the last 2 years, the Army has been using the computer game for combat training as well as recruiting. America's Army online video now has 6 million registered users. The Army believes that the combat vets like Sergeant Wolfert can assist in recruiting and training new soldiers. As of today, an estimated 100,000 plus Iraqis have died since the U.S. invasion. And according to the Department of Defense, over 2,100 Americans have died, including 35 from Oregon.
Philippine state prosecutors today filed rape charges against 4 U.S. Marines for allegedly assaulting a 22-year-old Filipino woman. The rape occurred while Marines were in the country for military training exercises last month. Girly Linneo in Manila reports.
According to prosecutors, only one of the 4 Marines actually sexually assaulted the victim on November 1 inside a rented van at the former U.S. Naval Base of Subic in the northern city of Olongapo. But the 3 other soldiers and the Filipino driver of the van were also charged with rape for allegedly encouraging the attack. 2 other soldiers initially included in the complaint were cleared after they presented evidence they were not in the van at the time of the alleged crime. Olongapo City Chief Prosecutor Prudencio Halandoni said the local court could issue arrest warrants against U.S. Marine Lance Corporal Daniel Smith, Lance Corporal Keith Silkwood, Lance Corporal Dominic Duplantis, and Staff Sergeant Chad Carpentier as early as next week. He noted that while only Smith admitted to having sex with the victim, the others were also liable because they cheered when the crime took place. No trial date has been set for the case, which has become controversial in the Philippines, for reviving old haunts of abuses committed by American troops when the country still hosted U.S. military bases. Since the allegations emerged last month, nationalists and women's groups have demanded that the Philippine government cancel its visiting forces agreement with the United States that allows American soldiers to train in the country. Critics warned the bilateral accord could be used to shield the Marines' charge in the rape case. But defense lawyer John Coluso offered assurances that no law was being bent to favor the accused.
We should also not forget that the presumption of innocence is still with the respondents. No, so I'm appealing to our countrymen to have a more objective mind. No, I do not know of the past cases involving Americans and Filipinos. Mm-hmm. I always look at one case at a time. Mm-hmm. All I'm appealing for is, insofar as this case is concerned, let's give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. And let the law take its course. No?
Lawyer Katrina Legarda, counsel for the victim, said state prosecutors have a strong case, especially after one of the Marines admitted to U.S. naval investigators that he had sex with the woman. Legarda noted that while the accused claimed the sex was consensual, the prosecution says it has evidence to prove otherwise.
The only issue now is whether or not there was consent. We have witnesses who saw her being carried out to the van. We have witnesses showing that she was not in a position to give consent because she was clearly under the influence of alcohol or some other substance. No? And then we have witnesses showing how she was thrown out of the van. And we have the medical legal for this case that shows that there are lots and lots of bruises and hematoma and contusions on her body and on her vaginal area, which certainly does not show consent.
Legarda added that even if the other Marines did not forcibly have sex with the victim, they were also technically liable for rape.
Under our criminal law, there can be gang rape in the sense that others were together encouraging or cooperating with the rape itself, and that is considered rape by all of them.
Defense lawyer Coluso disagrees. He contends that there is no legal basis to convict his 2 clients who merely witnessed what is now an alleged crime.
With due respect to the side of the complainant, I believe that there is no legal basis to convict the respondents, specifically my 2 clients. There is nothing in the law which punishes persons who are there, mm-hmm, at the scene of the commission of a supposed crime. They are confident in the sense that no wrong was committed, and mm-hmm. therefore, eventually, truth will be upheld. No? Although, of course, for a foreigner to be held to account for something in another country, no matter what they project, there would still be some sense of worry.
The U.S. Marines had participated in two-week training exercises in the Philippines. Since the complaint was filed against them last month, they have been in the custody of the U.S. Embassy in Manila, sparking outcry from nationalists and women's groups. In a statement, the U.S. Embassy said it would continue to cooperate with Philippine authorities on the case and added it was looking forward to a fair and impartial trial of those charged. The Philippines, a former colony of the United States, has asked for custody of the Marines. Washington has so far not replied to the request. Relations between the Philippines and the United States deteriorated in 1999 when the Philippine Senate voted not to renew leasing contracts for American military bases in the country, including the former U.S. naval base at Subic Bay. Ties were repaired in 1999 when the Senate ratified the Visiting Forces Agreement that permits U.S. troops to train with Filipino soldiers in the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurly Linao in Manila.
The current time is 5:36, and now Daily Commoner from Jim Hightower.
The internal memo is dated April 2005 and tagged IBM Confidential. The reason for the hush-hush treatment is that this document is written confirmation of corporate America's intention to offshore our nation's middle-class future, shipping out the jobs in engineering and other sciences that require advanced degrees and pay top wages. IBM, the world's largest information technology corporation, has become the leading practitioner of shopping the globe for the cheapest high-tech workers, knocking down the wage floor to the lowest common denominator. Because of the wrenching economic, social, and political impacts this will have on U.S. society, IBM has not wanted to concede publicly that undermining middle-class opportunities is a corporate goal. This leaked memo, however, confirms that while the top honchos are cutting 13,000 of these high-tech jobs in America and Europe this year, it will add 14,000 in the low-wage tech centers of India. Experienced software programmers in our country earn maybe $75,000 a year, creating a sound middle-class base for our economy and communities. But the hell with such democratic notions of the common good, say the profiteers, we can replace American programmers with ones from India who will do the work for $15,000 a year. That's $60,000 per job per year that the corporate and investor elites can take out of the middle class and put in their own pockets. Adding insult to injury, a top IBM executive says that the corporate rush to India is not merely a chase for the cheapest workers, but it's mostly about skills. He then proceeds to lecture America's high-tech workers. You are no longer competing just with a guy down the street, but also with people around the world. This is Jim Hightower saying, and there you have a sparkling clear statement of what corporate America thinks of you and has in store for you. How do they think they'll hold a society together when they knock down all of our wages to $15,000 a year? Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear the Queer Boo Collective show Out Loud, presenting a retrospective in 2005 and a listener call-in. And at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. Tonight's weather, rain, lows 40 to 45. Southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, increasing to south 15 to 20 miles per hour, with gusts to 35 miles per hour possible late. Tomorrow, rain in the morning, then showers. Breezy, highs around 50. South wind 20 to 25 miles per hour, with gusts to 45 miles per hour possible. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
several oil pipeline fires have broken out in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. This comes barely a week after the region recorded three other oil pipeline fires, which left some villages in ruins. Sam Okoya reports from Lagos.
The latest fire incident is on a pipeline that conveys petroleum products from a Niger Delta refinery to northern Nigeria. An official of the state-owned oil company says there are fires at several points along the pipeline. The cause of the fire is still unknown, but similar oil pipeline fires last week were blamed on militant youths. In one instance, a pipeline belonging to the Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell Petroleum was attacked with dynamite. A previously unknown militia group calling itself the Metals Brigade claimed responsibility for the attack. The attack forced Nigeria to cut its oil export by 7%. This slightly increased global oil prices. Nigeria is the world's sixth largest oil exporter. All of Nigeria's oil comes from the Niger Delta region, but the people rank among the poorest in the world. Billions of dollars in yearly profits from oil sales are mainly shared between the Nigerian government and Western oil companies. Local youths are increasingly resorting to violence to draw attention to their plight. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Sub-Saharan Africa will meet a deadline to use only unleaded gasoline by the end of 2005. Lead additives linked to disease and environmental damage are being phased out worldwide. South Africa, the last sub-Saharan country to complete the changeover, is on track for the December 31st deadline. The change stems from a pledge made at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in 2002, when almost all Africa was still using leaded fuel. Leaded fuel has already been phased out in most developed countries, but is still in use in some North African and Asian countries. Earlier this month, the changeover in South Africa caused fuel shortages throughout southern Africa as refineries shut down temporarily while they underwent the modifications needed to produce only unleaded fuel.
The presidents of Ukraine and Russia discussed a deepening dispute between their countries over gas prices and supplies. Russia wants to more than quadruple the price it charges Ukraine for gas to bring it in line with European market principles. Kyiv has been arguing for a phased increase over several years. Moscow has set a January 1st deadline for Kyiv to either agree to a price hike or face a cutoff of gas supplies. If a new agreement on gas prices is not signed before the new year, Moscow says it will stop gas supplies to the Ukrainian domestic market, a move that would leave Ukraine without about a third of its annual energy needs. Western Europe is closely following the standoff as it gets nearly one-fifth of its gas imports from Russia via Ukraine. Russia noted that the responsibility for any shortage of Russian gas supplies to its European customers will lie completely with the Ukrainians.
The BBC reports that Poland's government says it has taken the very difficult decision to extend its military deployment in Iraq until the end of 2006. The new conservative government's decision reverses the previous leftist administration's plan to pull troops out in early 2006. Poland, a staunch ally of the U.S., has about 1,500 troops stationed in Iraq. It is the fifth largest foreign contingent in Iraq after the U.S., Britain, South Korea, and Italy. But the Polish prime minister, elected in October's parliamentary elections, has asked the Polish president to keep them there for another year. Among other U.S. European allies, Bulgaria, Hungary, and the Ukraine have already opted to withdraw their forces. The last Ukrainian forces serving in Iraq left on Tuesday, the defense minister said. Their withdrawal coincided with that of the remaining 130 Bulgarian troops. Ukraine has contributed 1,650 troops to the U.S.-led coalition, the largest non-NATO contingent there. Earlier this week, Ukraine's President Viktor Yushchenko paid a surprise visit to Iraq and inspected the last Ukraine unit to be withdrawn. More than 10,000 people backing Sunni, Arab, and secular Shiite politicians have taken to the streets in Baghdad. The demonstrations are marching in favor of a government that could give more power to Sunni Arabs and secular Shiites.
Preliminary figures have given a big lead to the religious Shiite bloc that controls the current interim government. The demonstration comes amid a surge in violence that's killed more than 24 people, including a U.S. soldier. Officials say insurgents are trying to deepen the political turmoil surrounding the contested vote. Meanwhile, the military says a helicopter crash that killed two U.S. pilots last night was an accident.
Governor Schwarzenegger has been exterminated in his Austrian hometown. Yesterday, officials in the town of Graz removed Schwarzenegger's name from a soccer stadium. Today, they delete references to him on the city's websites, thus cutting off all ties to one of Austria's most famous sons. Schwarzenegger earlier this month wrote to Graz officials, ordering the city to stop using his name for promotional purposes. He was reacting to fierce criticism from opponents in his hometown, who denounced him for refusing to block the execution of death row inmate Stanley Tookie Williams. Capital punishment is illegal in Austria, and many people consider it to be barbaric. The government also returned a ring of honor the town gave him in 1999.
Tuesday formally marked the disbandment of the armed wing of Indonesia's Aceh rebels. Their 30-year-long separatist insurgency ended in the summer of 2005 after reaching a peace agreement spurred by last year's tsunami's devastation with the Indonesian government. In the agreement, the Indonesian government would allow the Free Aceh movement to form political parties if they dropped their demands for independence. Meanwhile, on December 26, people in Aceh, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and other places commemorated the one-year anniversary of the tsunami that wreaked havoc on their lives. 1 year after a 9.15 magnitude earthquake unleashed deadly waves, Thailand has finished rebuilding, but in Aceh and other parts of Sumatra, reconstruction is still going on. From Jakarta, FSRN correspondent Maggie Margiono reports that bureaucracy is one reason that rebuilding is slow going.
Thousands of people praying last year, December 26, 8 o'clock in the morning. As the economy has not yet recovered, few people are able to earn a living and are dependent on aid. School children still learn under tents, and the health situation has not yet normalized, as Indonesia's Minister of Health, Siti Fadila, explains.
Hopefully the health situation will get better. However, the health system has not yet recovered. For example, the doctors there are not paid on time, and this saddens me. I hope that the system of local government there gets better.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said that the public funds collected to help tsunami survivors reached the highest amount in world history, $2 billion U.S. dollars committed for Aceh from 44 countries, and some other portions of aid committed from Paris Club countries, including Australia, Canada, Britain, and the United States, are having their foreign aid loans paid off by tsunami donations. The Indonesian government has formed the reconstruction body for Aceh and Nias, but this body does not play an important role in Aceh. The rebuilding in Aceh today is done by around 400 foreign non-governmental organizations. George Peterson is with the World Health Organization in Jakarta.
Well, from the health point of view in Aceh, there are no epidemics. Somehow the situation is not so worse than in many other parts of Indonesia from the health sector side. But of course you have many people without any place to live and living in camps, and that's a hardship in itself.
One thing that makes the reconstruction body for Aceh and Nias unable to play a more important role is Jakarta's bureaucratic system. As Acehese parliament member Farhan Hamid puts it, it doesn't need a complicated process to fund money for reconstruction. Farhan says it needs to make the process simple to accelerate the rebuilding.
We are trying to break through all the regulation that had become an obstacle to reconstruction. For example, the presidential regulation on the process of tender has been changed, and now we have new regulations. Hopefully, there will be some progress in the next 2 or 3 months.
The peace deal between the Free Aceh movement and the Indonesian government also gives a positive contribution to the rebuilding. Thousands of humanitarian volunteers in Aceh now no longer face security problems as there is no more armed contact between the groups. However, ultra-right-wing politicians in Jakarta, who formally rejected a peace deal, now propose the division of Aceh into 3 provinces. Indonesia's parliament today discussed the draft law on Aceh province partitioning. Ghazali Abbas is Aceh representative in parliament. He rejects the separation proposal.
Only crazy people reject the peace deal. And only peace deal people can live peacefully. So only crazy people do not want to live peacefully.
If the majority in parliament supports the division of Aceh, a new conflict may break out in Aceh and make the rebuilding efforts more difficult. I'm Eric Klein, reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Kingdom is almost alone in Europe in honoring Kyoto pledges to cut greenhouse gases, according to the Institute for Public Policy Research. They find that 10 of 15 European Union signatories will miss the target without urgent action. The countries include Ireland, Italy, and Spain. France, Greece, and Germany will not reach targets unless they put planned policies into action, the IPPR said. The IPPR Associate Director Tony Grayland said, "We are nearing the point of no return on climate change. We have very little time left to start reducing global greenhouse gas emissions before irreparable damage is done." Under Kyoto commitments, the European signatories are supposed to cut their emissions to 8% below 1990 levels by 2008-2012. The Kyoto commitment have been undermined, critics says, because the U.S., the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, has refused to sign up to the treaty.
Israel is set to establish and enforce a buffer zone in the northern Gaza Strip 3 months after it withdrew from the territory. Leila El-Haddad has more from Gaza.
The buffer zone in the northern Gaza Strip will dig more than 5 kilometers deep into Palestinian land, encompassing two major towns, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz. The Israeli army says the buffer zone, which will be enforced by airstrikes and artillery fire, is needed to prevent Palestinian fighters from firing rockets into Israel. On Monday, 2 rockets were fired at the Israeli town of Sderot, causing no injury. Fighters say the rockets are to avenge Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank, as well as its strikes against their leadership in the Gaza Strip. In a pre-dawn attack today, the Israeli Air Force responded by striking 6 roads in northern Gaza and by dropping a bomb on a main street, blasting a massive crater into the ground. Fighter jets also broke the sound barrier over Gaza City throughout the night, causing thunderous shockwaves that rattled windows and shook buildings. In addition to the sonic booms and the airstrikes, the Israeli army has threatened it will begin to cut off electricity from the entire Gaza Strip to, quote, break support for resistance groups, a move that human rights groups have decried as collective punishment. For FSRN in Gaza, this is Leila El-Haddad.
Outsourced subway workers are on strike today in Buenos Aires to demand that the private subway company respect a collective labor contract granted to the workers. Maria Trigona reports from Buenos Aires striking workers from a company that scores to the Buenos Aires.
Striking workers from a company that outsources to the Buenos Aires Subway Authority protested this morning by blocking ticket booths at stations throughout the city and allowing passengers to ride for free. This prompted Metrovias, the private company that runs the Buenos Aires subway system, to quickly call for negotiations at the Labor Ministry. Union delegates are threatening to block train lines if the Metrovias company doesn't adhere to the demands of janitors and security guards from 3 temporary employment agencies. Outsourced subway workers have staged strikes over the past 3 months to demand increased salaries, better health benefits, and a 6-hour workday. Janitors and security guards were awarded the recognition of a labor contract in October after clashing with police and while shutting down all 5 subway lines. At deadline, the 2 sides were still in negotiations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Chigona in Buenos Aires.
At least 2 Israeli missiles hit areas in the Gaza Strip just 1 day after Israel promised to enforce a new buffer zone against militant rockets. There were no immediate reports of casualties after 1 missile exploded in Gaza City and a 2nd hit a Fatah party office. Palestinians said the missiles were fired by helicopter and that a 3rd had landed harmlessly in a field. On Monday, a Palestinian rocket exploded near an Israeli kindergarten. The rocket caused no injuries but went off as children were attending a Hanukkah party. Israeli artillery opened fire in response to the attack.
Rebellious inmates armed with makeshift knives held more than 200 people hostage at a prison in Brazil's remote Amazon jungle, state of Rondônia. The uprising began during visiting hours Sunday afternoon at the Urso Branco State Prison in the state capital, Porto Velho, some of 15,000 miles northwest of São Paulo. In all, 207 people, 190 women, and 17 men are being held hostage, said Renato Eduardo de Souza, head of the state's public safety department. All of them are relatives of the inmates. The inmates said they were released to hostages after one of their leaders, Edenido Paulo de Souza, who had been transferred to another facility about 1 month ago, was returned. Most of the 1,200 inmates at Erso Branco were taking part in the rebellion. The prison was built to hold 350 inmates. In April 2004, the Erso Branco prison was the site of a bloody five-day uprising that left 14 inmates dead. During the 5 days, prisoners held hostage about 100 relatives, most of them women.
The head of Brazil's own environmental agency estimates that 90% of all Amazon timber is illegally produced. In an effort to do something about it, a Greenpeace crew went undercover with a TV crew to produce a documentary on methods of purchasing and shipping timber from protected trees. Step one of the operation was to purchase the lumber from loggers operating illegally in Rondônia. Step two was to purchase necessary documents, which cost more than the lumber itself. Step three was shipping it across more than 1,600 miles of highway and across two inspection points. The fourth and final step in this sting operation was to deliver the goods and to file a crime report to authorities in Sao Paulo. The documentary was aired December 22nd on Fantastico, one of Brazil's most popular TV shows, to an audience of more than 40 million. Brazilian police thanked Greenpeace for delivering the wood and said they would start an investigation into the seller and those responsible for delivering the permits. Detectives also cut samples from the lumber to keep as evidence. That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 27th, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson, with help from Ross Egan. Tonight's audio editor is Kate Welch. Special thanks to reporter Ross Egan. Our engineer tonight is not Eduardo Del Andros Tierre, who is newly betrothed to Sherry Blackfeather. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Rolf Semprebon.
And I'm Latoya Hudson. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News at 7:30 a.m. Hear Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. His guest is Melanie Stone, Executive Director of Citizens for Ethics and Responsibilities in Washington. At 9, on Between the Covers, Elizabeth Fournier, author of Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, it's a panel discussion called The True Portland Comics. At 10, Stephanie Potter interviews Lucy Liu of the Freedom Project, which supports the transition of prisoners into peacemakers to build safe communities founded on effective connections. At 10:30, on stage and studio, Willamette Radio Theater presents A Christmas Carol. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer power, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 27th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Arctic Village, Alaska is holding its annual cultural celebration, which began on December 25th and continues through New Year's. The Gwich'in residents in Arctic Village, just south of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain, say this year they have even more reason to celebrate.
Every time somebody get up there to talk about the refuge, everybody clap and yell and scream and stuff like that.
Gwich'in Athabascan Sarah James has been advocating to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from oil and gas exploration almost as long as Alaska Senator Ted Stevens has been trying to tap into it. James says she and Stevens have one thing in common, Both are passionate about their cause.
I come into his office and he asked me, are you there for the same thing? And I said, yes. And then he started yelling at me, screaming and throwing his tantrum. And after he's done throwing his tantrum, then I said, okay, my turn.
James is a member of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. Formed in 1988 by elders in the region, the committee only has one resolution, to oppose development in Anwar and protect the porcupine caribou herd that calves there.
The elders direct us, they told us to go out to the world and educate the world in good way why we say no to oil and gas development.
The committee has been doing just that for almost 20 years. James says she spent from August until the most recent Senate hearing near the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., handing out information about the porcupine caribou, along with hundreds of supporters, many from other Native American communities. Alaska's congressional delegation says last week's vote not to include Anwar in the defense spending bill was a tremendous blow, especially for Senator Stevens, who has spent much of his career trying to open Anwar to development. In Arctic Village, however, the vote was a tremendous victory, but James says it's still only a temporary victory.
It's not a victory until it's a permanently protected, like wilderness protection or monument. I think wilderness bill had the most co-signer around this time around, but that would never happen in their administration.
This week's cultural celebration in Arctic Village includes feasting, dancing, and education about the porcupine caribou herd and the Gwich'in way of life. James says it's also a chance to thank those around the world who have helped the Gwich'in in their fight against opening Anwar. In other news, education leaders in South Dakota say the number of Native Americans in university classrooms is dismal. To buck that trend, the state is rolling out a new program this summer to increase the number of Native American students who earn college degrees. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Johanna Saylor reports.
Director of South Dakota's Indian Education Office, Keith Moore, says the state's nine reservations would benefit if more tribal members had college degrees. But the Rosebud Sioux tribal member says leaving the reservation presents a problem for many Native students.
A lot of our kids that come off the reservation, it is a, you know, a big, huge culture shock. A lot of our people fail and go back because they haven't been faced with those situations before in their lives.
Moore says a new summer program called Gear Up will increase the number of Native Americans on college campuses. He says the program will prepare middle and high school students for the upcoming school year. Plus, high school students will take the six-week summer program on a university campus.
What we're hoping is that these kids will feel comfortable heading off to college because of the time that they've spent on a college campus, living in the dorms, meeting college professors, and seeing everything firsthand for a number of years.
Moore says Gear Up is modeled after a program on the Pine Ridge Reservation that has increased the number of Native students graduating from college. The state received a $6.9 million matching federal grant to take the program statewide for 6 years. I'm Johanna Saylor, Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.